Hi everyone, welcome to Chinese Whispers. This is where we demystify the People's Republic of China. We are Amal and
Jyotsna.
We are foreign policy enthusiasts interested in understanding China.
Today we'll be talking about China's economic policies. What drives China's economy and where it is headed. We've decided to structure this episode along the format of an interview in a Q&A style. Why have we decided to do this? Because Amal here has been keeping an eye on developments in China's economy for some time. And he's been keen on Chinese economic history as well. So we might as well take advantage of his expertise. I'll be asking him questions about China's economic history, its domestic economic situation, its economic ties with the world, and how China's economy is shaping the world. So Amal, tell us a little bit about yourself first. How did you get interested in China's economy and how long have you been studying it?
Well, I'm a quasi-Chetan Bhagat. Well, I have the most uncommon set of degrees. Like I'm an engineer plus an MBA. Very uncommon.
Yeah.
So, I've been interested in understanding China for a while. Probably since 2010, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That was when I started... as a kid, when I was reading business news, I used to see that China is doing so well and our country is not. And that's mm-hmm. what got me interested to understand what exactly are they doing and what exactly are we doing? Like, why is this sort of a discrepancy and what is so great about, let's say, China and what is so not so great about us?
Yeah.
So that started off a fact-finding mission and that's why here I am with some knowledge at least. And just FYI, I'm not an economist, so things I might say might be wrong. But just I focus more on the political system because I think that's what differentiates a lot of amongst the two countries.
Yeah, because it's very peculiar in China's case. Right. So tell us a little bit more about how China's economy was structured before the establishment of the People's Republic in 1949.
Okay, so let's talk about... Like, let's ignore the Qing Dynasty era before 1912 for now. Let's focus on just a little bit on that. So, typically, empires have not industrialized unless and until they have been hammered by some other industrialized country or empire. For example, Japan started industrializing after it was invaded by Commodore Matthew Perry from the US in 1854. And Japan started the Meiji Restoration, which led Japan to become what it is right now. Similarly, China was also hammered during the Opium War, Opium Wars actually, but it did not actually start industrializing properly. It still believed that because it had a much larger economy because of the population, it just thought maybe it can handle it. Efforts to industrialize later on in the later part of the 19th century or in the early part of the 20th century also were all staggered or like sort of stopped by Empress Cixi. That is the Dowager Cixi. And so even by then, the first rail lines were not constructed. I think there was one constructed and that sort of led to a financial crisis in the early Qing Empire, in the later stages of the Qing Empire. And coming to the warlord era, that is a very fascinating time because there was no centralized power in China. There were different warlords fighting each other for basically control over Beijing.
Yeah.
And they could not. Pretty much.
Mm.
So even though there was a supposed ROC government, but it was a pretty crazy time.
Yeah.
So the trade was roughly the same. Industrialization levels were low. As I've said in the podcast before, that the coast was trading, the interior was not. They spent more money on actually fighting each other than actually running any form of factory.
Yeah.
The only... area was that was industrialized like to a significant level was Manchuria, where Japan had invaded and Japan had built up a good form of industrial base sort of to offload the low value production onto the Chinese, like the poor at that point of time low wage Chinese workers. And the warlord back then, Zhang Zuoling, I think that was his name, so he was one of the richest warlords at that point of time for that reason, and he was vying for control over Beijing. Too bad he died much before that.
Let's discuss some of the key phases and key changes that were brought about after the establishment of China. So a bit more about the political economy of the People's Republic of China through the years.
Sure. So let's take this in two phases.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's just cover 1949 to up until, let's say, 1978.
Okay.
So initially, Mao's entry, or rather the CCP's entry into mainstream Chinese, into mainstream China, sort of changed everything. So they obviously believed in the standard communist policies of, you know, pushing everybody into a commune, the state owns everything, etc. There was no private incentive. So it was the famous communist centrally planned economy.
Mm.
One of some of the good things they did was constructing lots of dams to sort of produce electricity. They actually did a very good job of constructing roads everywhere to connect all the people. This is one of the lesser talked about things, actually.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful thing for them. And subsequently, Mao came up with a quote-unquote great idea called the Great Leap Forward. That was his intent to make China a fully industrialized country. And he wanted to produce steel at a large scale and also increase grain production. So that was his effect, his effort to shift people from farming to, from broader agriculture to the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he was trying to increase productivity in grain production and also increase steel production. Like one of his targets was to overtake Britain at that point of time in steel production,
yes,
which they have done very well by now, but that's what the target was.
Yeah.
And that did not work out even remotely well. It mm-hmm. led to a huge famine.
Yeah.
People were even burning pots and pans to produce in backyard furnaces to produce steel. Yeah.
Mm.
So it was not a good time, which kind of led to a financial crisis later on.
I see. But China is rich now. How does one make money in China? So, you know, there is an American dream. You can go to America, supposedly, with not a lot on you, and you can still make it big. And in fact, some people are even talking about an Indian dream. And incidentally, even Donald Trump endorsed that idea at the Motera Stadium recently. There's the story of the Ambanis who rose from nothing. How does one rise in China? Do you have to be a member of the Communist Party?
Mm-hmm. So, okay, that's a very good question. So let's compare, for now, US and China.
Mm-hmm.
So fundamentally, these two systems, like just to answer your question in this case, these two systems are completely different, as we all know.
Yeah.
US wants to grow its GDP so that people can be, or rather largely people can be wealthier privately, that their own happiness, their own wealth increases.
Yes.
China wants to grow rich so that the Communist Party can gain more power.
Hmm.
Because the CCP is a very, very controlling giant, as we have talked about before also. So that's why if you want to be rich in China, you have to be CCP approved in some way or the other. So either you are a member of the CCP or you are forced to co-opt into, like, just basically join CCP and assist them with quote-unquote national rejuvenation, as they call it.
Hmm.
Yep. And that's why when you become big, you are forced to fall in line. For example, in any company, if you have more than 50 employees, one of them has to be a Communist Party member without any leeway.
Hmm.
So the long arm of the CCP is everywhere in this case.
Hmm. So next time I see Chinese people thronging at the Louis Vuitton store at Champs-Élysées, it's likely that they have links to the party back home.
Extremely likely, yes.
Right.
Yeah. They might not say it, but they will.
Mm-hmm. And what about private ownership? So do these people do well with private, if they have private companies, or is it just state-owned enterprises that perform well in China? What are the key differences and who's really running the show?
Who's really running the show, as in, like, who's the one in charge or what?
Between the state-owned enterprises and private companies in China, who's contributing more to the economy?
Okay, that's a very, like, even contributing, the term itself is a little messy, but let me add to that.
Yeah.
So, to start with, in CCP, literally nothing is private.
Yeah. Like
within CCP-controlled China, nothing is private. everything is owned by the state to start with.
Mm.
You, whatever is private, you are, it's called, I mean, you are allowed to have use rights over it, not ownership rights. So yeah. When Deng Xiaoping had started liberalizing the economy in 1978, he had to come up with this innovation called use rights over land or any sort of property. This is one of the fundamental things necessary for any sort of economic expansion. We all agree on that.
Yeah.
So Deng had created this use rights concept that, let's say you own land, but you just have the right to use it for, I think, 80 years or something. You don't really own it in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fundamental concept behind this. Now, when private companies come in, that was Deng's effort to sort of add an element of private incentive. And that's what, grows the economy anywhere in the world. And because of that, private companies have typically performed much better. In fact, during the growth phases, the private companies were actually very powerful. The small scale SMEs in the 90s, the ones who were exporting, and in the 2000s also, they were making a very significant contribution by exporting, bringing in foreign exchange, and also improving the overall productivity and tech advancement in China.
Yeah.
They were doing a very good role in that. However, they were also sort of controlled by providing small amounts of subsidized loans, like the ones who are submitting to the CCP get better subsidized loans, etc.
Yes.
So that was a very efficient market, and it still is to a large extent, despite what some people might say, or even I might say, actually. But on the other hand, there are those bigger companies which are quasi-private. For example, I think you have read the report on
Huawei. Yeah.
And you've written on that also.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really private, but private. So it's kind of a messy thing to answer. But there is a huge amount of government control. But it is by default that larger enterprises are much more inefficient and not very productive overall.
Yeah. And it's often very difficult to establish links between private companies and, say, their patrons within the party.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
And you can always assume that the CCP is there.
It's always there. Even in private companies, yeah.
Yeah, through and through.
Yeah. Yeah, it's again private companies with Chinese characteristics, because you have to have someone from the party in the office or in the board who has some sort of oversight over the operations of your company.
Yes, and it's funny that they often go about bragging about it, that yes, this is why the CCP controlled companies are performing so well and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Just highlighting a specific growth period in the economy.
Mm.
Yeah. It's a very strange situation for them.
Okay, so tell me about this. Often this achievement gets thrown around regarding the party, that it has brought millions out of poverty. How much truth is there in these claims? And secondly, how bad is income equality in China? What is the situation like in terms of the regional divide, the urban-rural divide, and just generally economic disparity in China?
So to answer that, let's attack the poverty question first.
Okay.
So has the income levels of all people increased broadly? Yes. A resounding yes, it has, without a doubt. In fact, even amongst the poorest parts of the population, it has increased.
Okay.
But the definition of poverty itself is a big question.
Oh, I see.
And the scale of increase is a big question.
Mm-hmm.
For example, China claims to pull a lot of people out of poverty, roughly, I think they have a very small number in below $1.9 a day.
Okay.
But in the gap between $1.9 a day to $10 a day, they have, I think, 900 million people in that group. That's pretty much the entire country.
Yeah.
Which earns between $1.9 to $10 a day.
Yeah.
So, and the top cream, makes pretty much all the money. And again, I'm not saying this is completely wrong. This sort of a graph is very common, that the top 20% makes, I think, 60, 70, 80, high percentage
of
the
money. It's common in many countries, yes.
Yes. So that's why there is the wonderful statistical genius called the Gini coefficient.
Hmm.
That's what defines the level of inequality in a country.
Yes.
Now, let's be fair, that Gini coefficient, like, it's a bit of statistics in this case.
Hmm.
So, for example, the higher the Gini coefficient, the more the inequality.
Okay.
Now, is it good kind of inequality? Is it bad kind of inequality? That's a separate question. It all depends on the income levels. For example, India's is 0.35, Bangladesh's is 0.32,
mm-hmm.
something in the same range.
Mm.
Although the Gini coefficient increases with increase in the overall wealth of the country.
Yes.
Because, yeah. you know, if there are lots of people on the streets, you can't really go down much. You can only go up.
Yeah.
So as you go up, some people will get richer in the process. So mm-hmm. that's why US is kind of a benchmark, 0.41, I would mm-hmm. say for now. As compared to this, China is doing horribly.
Mm.
So here's the funny story. So China has is a middle income country technically.
Yeah.
But the Gini coefficient is humongously worse.
Mm.
So for example, as far as I remember, it's not even allowed legally to talk about the Gini coefficient in China.
Oh, just wow. FYI. Yeah.
I think it was one of the former economists who said this, that I just cannot talk about the Gini coefficient. That number is not known at all initially. In wow. The late 2000s. Yeah, sorry?
Yeah. No, go on.
Yeah, so in the late 2000s, they were asked multiple times by different international organizations, like, what is the Gini coefficient? Let us know. They never said it.
Oh, wow. So when that's why the numbers are not, you know, really known. Accurately.
Yeah, but later on they said some things. Okay. For example, I think in 2013 they said, okay, it's 0.47.
Okay.
Which is very bad.
Yeah.
But the thing is, this is a CCP approved number.
So, yeah.
you know where this is going to go.
Yeah, so if it's a party approved, but it is still that bad.
yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a separate study done by one university in Chengdu.
Mm-hmm.
They said it's 0.61.
Okay.
Which is again, like, I think probably the worst inequality in the world by this definition.
Yeah.
And it doesn't end there, actually. I think another, I forgot the economist's name. I think one economist who was associated with the National Bureau of Statistics before,
mm-hmm.
he said it's 0.8 or something.
Oh, wow.
So that's like the worst you can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the economic inequality is bad and it is a very difficult political challenge for the CCP.
Hmm.
So, and the disparity is actually huge. Less about urban-rural and more about coastal versus interior. So, it's also about urban-rural. But the idea is that they show you the China, which is like, you know, for example, Shanghai skyline, like tall buildings and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Shanghai has become rich thanks to trading and finances, etc. Mm-hmm. But most of China doesn't look like that. It's the other extreme. It's most of what we see in rural India, China is pretty much the same.
Yeah.
So that's why the so-called fast growth is there on the coast. Maybe not as much on the rural areas, but in the cities, yes.
Yeah.
So that's why it is said that China is the most likely country to be stuck in the middle income trap.
Hmm.
Just like, for example, Brazil.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be pretty for China in the near future, at least.
Yeah, because their economic performance is the only source of legitimacy for the CCP. Or at least the biggest major source of legitimacy for those guys.
Yes.
Okay.
That is what Xi Jinping is trying to change, right? Like trying to force Xi Jinping thought and stuff like that. But let's see how they manage it.
Trying to create enemies and... Right. So, you know, when you started, you said that what really got you interested was thinking about how China does so well and India doesn't do as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people say that it's much easier to do well when you're an authoritarian China than when you're a chaotic, democratic India. So what are the costs versus benefits when it comes to the economic health of a country under a government like the CCP?
So that statement that it's easier to do in an authoritarian China, easier to do well than in a democratic India is patently false.
Yeah.
Let's forget about democratic, the word democratic in this case. Let's talk about inclusivity.
Hmm.
So China had to become more inclusive in during Deng Xiaoping's time to get some sort of economic growth.
Yeah.
India's problem is of a different kind. Like, these are apples and oranges. So for China, they initially pushed a lot of inclusivity, but then the long arm of the CCP walked into it. And by now, the inclusivity is, I guess, it's very low. I mean, given how Xi Jinping is operating.
Yeah, by inclusivity, you mean including everyone in the economic process? What do you mean by inclusivity?
Yes.
Yeah.
So inclusivity as in, if I'm a startup with a certain technology, no bigger giant should be able to crush me.
I see.
Just
yes.
Because they have more money.
Yeah. Or they're
that sort of
connected thing. To someone. Yeah.
Yeah, or they're connected to someone. Like, you need basic rule of law, like an fair and balanced rule of law.
Right. Yeah, so, and there is no rule of law in China, so.
Exactly. Mm. So they did perform some sort of, like, you know, let's call it rule of law gymnastics for now, which they did during Deng Xiaoping's time.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it won't last long. Like, it's not a very stable institution to start with. Like, Xi Jinping has destroyed many of those rules just like that.
Yeah.
Like, all those structural two-term limits, etc. are all dead.
Hmm.
So, on the other hand, in democratic India, we have a different kind of a problem. For us, the rule of law is not being enforced properly by the courts because the courts are clogged.
Yeah.
So, that sort of slows things down. And because we have a history of, like, our bureaucracy, the set of institutions which runs it, is effectively initially an extractive British bureaucracy plus an overlay of a socialist bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So that's why starting 1991, we are just unwinding and using Sanjeev Sahaya.
Still in the process.
Yeah, we are still in the process. So that's why broadly we have a much brighter future in this case.
That makes me feel good. Okay. so China, you know, we all know that it is a manufacturing and trading giant. But it has remained on the top with the help from, say, currency manipulation, intellectual property theft, and also trading barriers. Would you say that this is exaggerated, say, from people like Trump?
No.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, there might be like a 20% exaggeration or something, but I don't think these accusations are false.
Yeah.
In fact, they might have, for example, China used to manipulate currency to make it cheaper in the 2000s. But in the last decade, in the 2010 decade, it has actually manipulated more the other way around to prevent it from going too cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that accusation might have come in a little too late, but that there is a huge amount of truth in the accusation.
Yes.
In fact, even on IP theft, 1 in 5 corporations in the US say that China has stolen their intellectual property.
Wow.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
and mercantilism, that's a very common story. Like, in China, you get very cheap loans. Your loans are simply let go of if you can't pay it back. That's why the banks are in a very bad situation.
Hmm.
That's why the central bank keeps reducing its reserve requirement ratio to make sure that it can lend even more. Which by now, I think they have run off on all the capacity they have. But let's see how they manage it.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Coming to the Belt and Road Initiative, how is China able to finance these multi-billion-dollar infrastructure projects in like countries that obviously cannot pay for them? Or does it even matter that these countries are not able to pay for it? Because ultimately, all China cares about is to acquire strategic assets in these countries. What is the true cost of the Belt and Road Initiative for China?
I don't think the cost even matters here.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the more nuanced things about China that we are not yet aware of properly, like at least people living in nation states outside, or I mean democratic proper states outside.
Yeah.
Is how much the face of the emperor matters. Like, China is still an empire. They still want to show a face. They show that face to their own public that, hey, this is Xi Jinping's great, grand, you can add whatever adjectives you want, initiative, is the, like, the appearance of China on the global stage.
Yeah.
So historically, China, if you look at Chinese empires, they have never actually traded with the world, like almost never, pretty much. except in, during the Song Dynasty and in the late 19th century. Otherwise, not much.
Yeah.
So, the only sort of trading they have actually done, or rather, the vast majority of the trade they have actually done, is with their satraps, the tributary empires.
Yeah.
That the tributary empires give money and they give something in return. That's the only, that's pretty much the only type of trade they've done historically. So that's why they're trying to, the Xi Jinping is, appears to be trying, like, you know, trying to portray some sort of an image like that. And there's a very wonderful example actually from history, which sort of reminds me of the situation today. So the Song Dynasty from the 10th, I think the 10th century to the 12th century, something along this line, was actually a very inclusive and open dynasty. Like, that was the time when many of the famous Chinese inventions happened, like the padlocks, gunpowder, etc. Right after that, there was a short blip of the Mongols, where the Yuan dynasty, that was what they call it. So during the Song Dynasty, a bunch of institutions had been set up which had made China very rich, and sort of, like, in fact, they had pretty much become a small superpower at that point of time. However, when the Ming Dynasty came in, they said, oh, no, we Ming Dynasty started behaving the same way as Xi Jinping is doing right now.
Yeah.
And first of all, started showing off to the world that, hey, we are awesome. They actually subsidized trade with other countries. That seems very familiar, doesn't it? Huh?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And they also went off to portray, like, to show off on how awesome they are by sending Zhang He, that great fleet, which is still well known. But after that, because they ran short of money, they just stopped that. So this is the thing that we see as a parallel, that they do things, they subsidize foreign trade to show off that, hey, we are awesome and we are rich, not just to people outside, but to their own people.
So BRI is essentially just show off, and you get some strategic leverage in return sometimes.
There's another aspect to that, that is finances. For example, you also maybe look at what sort of a return you get from the money that you've spent.
Yeah.
So the internal returns on within China is so low by now, I mean, I guess, that they are more than happy to sink money elsewhere so that they at least get some sort of a return, even at least strategic returns to that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So are we seeing a trend towards economic decoupling with China?
Yes.
From the US or elsewhere?
Yes. So there is an argument that often floats around that China has been the great trading superpower throughout history. That's, again, a flat lie. Once again, the only time China has actually traded in its ancient history was during the Song Dynasty. They also invented the compass, by the way.
Yeah. But
after the Song Dynasty invented the compass, they started blocking out trading every few decades with the rest of the world. So China actually loves being in isolation because the emperor can control his population very effectively.
Yeah.
But otherwise, whenever there has been a trading period, the emperor has been very weak, which, you know, CCP doesn't like.
Yeah.
So even if the rest of the world doesn't want complete isolation, CCP wants a near isolation.
So it's not just Trump that's going after it.
Yes. Xi Jinping is also after it. That's why they love each other for that reason, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so coming to the coronavirus, how is it impacting the Chinese economy?
Okay, that's actually a full podcast worth of a topic, but let me cover some basics on this.
In brief, so yeah.
It comes at a very... I'm sorry?
Yeah, just shortly, that's it.
Sure, so it comes at a very interesting moment when things for China are actually very bad. So bad as in the level of debt they have. So let's say, I mean, this could result in some sort of a 2008 style real estate bubble, which the bubble already exists. There is a chance that it can break off the bubble.
Yeah.
Or burst the bubble, I mean. So for example, let's say your house is priced at $100 and you have taken in $90 of debt and $10 are your own equity. And suddenly the price of the house drops by $10, let's say.
Hmm.
So technically it's all debt, like you don't really own the house.
Yeah.
So that's a fundamental problem that happens whenever there is a high amount of debt and shocks like these come in. So China does not appear to be in a situation where it can actually absorb this sort of a shock. Mm. We are yet to see how exactly this will turn out.
Yeah.
I mean, to our listeners, there's this book called The House of Debt by the famous Ahmadi Pakistani economist named Atif Mia. It's a very good read on this particular topic on how house debt can lead to issues on this front, which pretty much China is surviving on, the real estate industry. And there's another factor behind this, that China is trying to portray a face that they are doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things they know that different economists look at is the electricity data. Like different people have claimed that that's the best availability, that's the best number they can show for economic activity. So they have kind of set in mandated targets for different provinces, it appears, that you have to produce this much electricity. So that's why some of these provinces, at least there's one case of visible from Zhejiang province, that they're making factories run without production to somehow consume electricity for fun.
Wow, that's like great leap forward all over again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's why China, things don't look even remotely good for China right now.
Oh God. Yeah. And then you add coronavirus to that. That's a deadly cocktail.
Yep.
Okay, guys.
I mean, it's not just that. There are many other issues that have come up. Like there's another H1. I think there was a hepatitis epidemic that's coming in northern China, etc. Yeah. Like there are many issues.
Yeah. So, that's all for today, guys. Thank you, Amal. Thank you for explaining everything and giving a good overview over what's going on and how China's economic policies have been structured over the years. More on China in our next episode. Do send us your feedback and comments. We'll link our Twitter below in the description. Also, feel free to send us questions that you'd like to see addressed. If you like this podcast, do share the link and subscribe to our channel. So until next time, see you and thank you.